Who's that?
Our listeners didn't have their audio on too loud.
Yeah.
That is two groups of coyotes yelling at each other from across a river.
Wow.
They really put up a racket.
That is a confusing sound, even if you've heard it before. I don't know. I mean, it's a weird thing to say, but it's...
They're like, I don't know. It's very loud. It's very yappy.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I don't know. Kind of... They give me Chihuahua vibes. Like, very yappy.
I was going to say, explain more.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
They just sound like...
Ankle biters?
A little cantankerous, you know, to use a John Latimer word.
Yeah.
Two groups of coyotes.
They're kind of old guys sitting around complaining to each other, kind of a feel?
Yeah, or like two groups of testosterone-crazed teenagers kind of yelling at each other,
oh,
but
sure.
Not really like knowing how to fight yet, but just being like, grr. Yeah.
There we go, Charlie Mitchell, anthropomorphizing nature again. But
oh, man.
It's because we feel so close to it. This is the Season Watch Pod, a production of KEXE. And each week we get a chance to talk about what's going on in nature and really keep ourselves curious. I have a better week if I'm a little bit curious about nature. How about you?
I sure do, too. Yeah, a little bit of curiosity goes a long way. Keeping you interested and engaged and not lost in the screen.
Yeah. You know, last week began the kind of talk of slight signs of spring. And then this week, more so from our nature reports and from John's report. And then the very next day, we've got 5 inches of snow here.
I mean, if that isn't spring in Minnesota, I don't know. Well, you guys got 5 inches of snow.
Yeah, sorry.
We got
bragging.
Rain and like a little dusting.
It began last night with noisy rain, which I always find very confusing. It was like, and it was windy, so it was hitting the windows of our house. It was like, you know, it wasn't sleet.
Was it ticking?
Yeah, it wasn't sleet exactly. Might have been grouple. John Latimer's favorite thing. And there are so many different words for sleet, freezing rain, freezing fog. Sometimes you hear grouple, you know, all these different things. But so began with that. And then snow wasn't really intense until much later and then overnight. And it's so thick. I can't wait to hear. John is a little bit obsessed, I would say, with melting down his snow to figure out the water content.
Yes, he does love to melt down his snow to figure out how much water is in there. He's got a whole tactic. He keeps careful. I mean, he's John, so of course he keeps careful records.
Mm-hmm.
Who would John Latimer be without writing everything down? Yeah, I will be interested to hear exactly how wet the snow was in full detail next week.
Most things, because John's interested, I am interested. That's sort of been the trajectory of phenology, right? Is if you hear someone excited and curious, you become so yourself because it's just addictive, or that's not the right word, inspiring or something.
Yeah.
Not so much for me with this melting down the snow. I'm going to be honest.
No.
Sorry, John.
Yeah. Not not tickling your interest as much.
No, it's okay.
Fair enough.
I can just kind of zone out a little bit.
Yeah. And like everyone has their thing. Meteorology, fascinating for some people. I mean, I like weather. It's never been the thing that I want to learn about necessarily.
Yeah.
And like, I should really enjoy hydrology, how rivers and lakes and all that stuff works. And like, there's a huge field of biology that you can go into as a hydrologist. And it just never struck me as something that I like wanted to actually study, but career limiting lack of interest for me.
I mean, I want to know how much snow, but that's where it ends for me. So, but
yeah,
go for it, John. We always want to know what you're interested in, and that's okay. I get to hang out with them every week on that front. So also unusual, though, in our weather was thunder snow and lightning. Very confusing.
Snunder.
That's the thing.
It is now. You know, just shove the two words together. Snow and thunder, snunder.
There we go.
You also got lightning?
Uh-huh.
Well, if you got thunder, there's lightning. That would logically make sense.
Very strange.
That's interesting. I know in early spring is when the proper time is to gather, like, the bark from dogwoods to make kinnikinick or, like, traditional tobacco. The proper time to gather it is before the first thunder.
Hmm.
And so I
Might have
wonder
messed it
if,
up a little.
yeah,
It's pretty
that's
early thunder,
fascinating.
perhaps.
Yeah.
I did learn some dogwood this week because we were looking out at the rain garden as we sat in the studios here on the banks of the Mississippi River. And I asked John, I always assume if I see a red kind of bush branch, red osier dogwood, like the only thing I know. Turns out it is dogwood. It is not the red osier dogwood that I'm seeing. But that got us into a really interesting conversation about the slight color variations that we're going to be starting to see from things like dogwoods.
Yeah, we've got a bunch of different species dogwoods, and I don't know whether it's by species necessarily, but the colors they turn are just phenomenal. The red osier is the one that is red all the way down to the base of the trunk of the little tree, sapling, bush, shrub, insert word here. But I think most dogwoods turn some sort of coral or burgundy or red. Up near the tips of their branches, some of them have this like lime green that transitions into red. They're gorgeous. And then the willows tend to be yellow. But yeah, lots of good colors along the roadsides right now.
John, as he was heading out to classrooms this week, was going to start the branch experiment with them, is what he's
Oh,
saying. So,
yes. If people don't know about the branch experiment, it is a annual delight for our phenology classes. They go out and gather twigs from a variety of different trees, generally like red maple, maybe an invasive tree like a buckthorn, an oak, and just grab a little branch of tree and put it in water in their classroom. Once the twig's inside, it sits in the warm and the sun from the window, and they start budding out. And depending on the species of tree, it can take a couple days or it can take a couple of weeks, and you're able to like make some really cool conclusions about the trees based on how long it takes them to bud out. So invasive species that aren't adapted to winter tend to bud out pretty early, because in their natural habitats, they don't need to worry about frost. Whereas a red maple that's very adapted to northern climates takes a long time before it's ready to bud out, because it doesn't want to lose its buds to the next cold snap. But the nice thing is you get a little bouquet of nice flowers and green leaves a couple weeks earlier than everywhere else.
We did that at our house once, so you don't have to be a student to do that one. It's a good way to kind of watch what's going on out there.
Yeah. I clipped a couple of pussy willow twigs while I was out this weekend and brought them
Nice.
inside.
And I did not know,
Just
that's
nice to.
another thing I was learning in John Latimer's, how many different kinds of pussy willows there are. Holy cow.
Oh, yeah. Yep. A lot of them. And all of them, when I run John Latimer's report through the transcription service, it always bleeps pussy willow. Makes me laugh every time.
Wow. The word police? I don't know what the word is. Big brother
Yeah.
watching out there? That's not, yeah. Well, speaking of that, I think we should, I want to hear what one of our classrooms had to say this week.
Yeah, absolutely. This one's coming from Prairie Creek Community School, way down south in Northfield, Minnesota.
Hi, I'm Letty.
And I'm Grace.
And we're from Prairie Creek Community School.
Way down south in Northfield, Minnesota.
This morning, Michelle heard a few cardinals singing before dawn.
Spring is on its way.
The willow trees are turning brighter yellow.
That's another sign of spring.
There have been a ton of deer.
Esri saw an eagle eating a deer.
An eagle almost hit Natalie's car.
Many of us have also seen eagles.
But not as close as Natalie did.
I saw a quail walking across the street and a possum in the road.
Hugo saw a baby squirrel.
Oscar saw a pheasant and a dead buck.
This has been Prairie Creek.
One more step along the phenology journey.
A quail, a pheasant, a bald eagle almost running into your car, and a possum.
All the things. Have you been to the classroom at Prairie
Yes,
Creek? What
yeah.
what's it like?
So they have a school building, but they spend a lot of their time outside. They have an outdoor classroom and a lot of like good land to be on. They're right next to a field, so they get to see a lot of the more open area critters. They have a little forest and then a stream running through. They've got great habitat to be watching for critters, and those kids absolutely love their time outside. Michelle Martin is a phenomenal teacher. I've really enjoyed my trips out to see that crew. Those kids know so much. I know I've said this before on the podcast, but man, if I had gotten that kind of a head start on knowing all this stuff that I'm picking up in my 30s, I would know so much by now, you know?
Yeah, but doesn't that then make you want to know more, even if you knew all that more? You're just gonna kind of keep digging in and digging in.
Accumulating.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're hearing cardinals singing. I've been hearing a little bit of that here. Do you have cardinals up where you are, or just do they move north in
Some.
spring, or?
I don't see them very often where we are. Actually, no, we had a pair last year by our house, but yeah, I always feel like I wish they seem so striking that I wish I saw them more often here, but they are. I
Yeah.
think they're moving north. Yeah.
They are beautiful. Yeah. And their call is so, I don't know, arresting. Just that car alarm, like, wacheer, wacheer, rip, 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 rip. Yeah. Easy to hear sign of spring, and sometimes a little bit too loud for some people's liking.
I made sure before I left the house today of making sure that bird feeder was full that's right outside my window because I felt so bad it was covered in snow when I saw one of the birds land on it. Okay, we'll get these for you here. They're not quite ready for that. Speaking of birds, this week I learned a lot about something I knew nothing about, and that's the kestrel.
Yeah, the American kestrel. So not really around right now. It does migrate, but it will be returning soon. An incredibly charismatic little predatory bird. I would say it's skinnier than a robin, but also like a little bit taller than a robin. To me, it's about the same size visually, even though its proportions are different. And just an incredibly striking little friend to see along roadsides and stuff in the summer.
You know, as we were talking to Clinton Dexter Nienhaus from, he's the head naturalist at the Saxton Bog, I was looking up what they look like. So, because we hadn't really quite asked him that. And I love like patterns, like stripes and polka dots. And that's what I was seeing on the male kestrels was both those things. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, they're gorgeous and like the slate blue kind of color. They've got really interesting kind of patches of color on their face, especially the males. And
Like a longer
they're.
tail too, right? Yeah.
Yep, longer tail. And they're like, a lot of their diet is insects, which is fun for a falcon.
Well, take a listen to part of this conversation and a big thank you, of course, to Mark Jacobs, who is our producer.
Are just such cool birds, and their call is very distinctive, and they're easy to see because a lot of times they're perched up on, telephone wires along fields and stuff. So they're one of the more easily observed birds in the summer. A joy to watch and to see, and like to see them hunt as well.
We just got a call asking about what size of a box to use for the kestrels.
Good question. So the whole entry size is really the big thing. So they can be, 17, 18 inches tall. They can be taller than that. But really, it's that entry hole. So a wood duck box, if we think about that hole, maybe a little bigger than 3 inches, that's a little too big. And then if you go like below 2.5, that's a little too small. So on our website, so on the Friends of Saxon Bog website, if you want to learn more about our research on kestrels, we have a whole series. Every year, I've done a report. So you can go from year one to year 10. And you can see the report. I think on the first one, we have a little mock-up of here's what American Kestrel Conservancy says works for kestrels. So they give you diagrams and they give you measurements and the cutting list for everything you need for boxes there. I'd also shout out Woodworking for Wildlife. Carol Henderson wrote a book in the 80s or 90s. I think there's also some plans in there for not only kestrels, but for screech owls, which saw-whets would use up here, for wood ducks, that sort of stuff. So a little bit smaller than a wood duck box, but a little bit bigger than, maybe your standard bluebird box or something like that. Good question.
What are you thinking? What's the hope for the future of kestrels? How are they doing?
Yeah, so again, it's maybe not great to hear decline and an annual decline of about 2%, but I think the nice thing about kestrels, above and beyond maybe other species, is that you kind of have to think about everything when we talk conservation with kestrels. We can't just like, oh, put up a box and that's good. Well, put up a box by a highway and you're going to lose birds because you're going to get them hit by cars, right? So we got to find sort of this match of where does habitat exist or where does this habitat fit this bird? Does it have the food that it wants? Is the food that it wants doing okay, right? So we kind of can think about kestrels holistically when we think about conservation, because we need trees, right? Dead trees or cavities. We need insect populations that are doing okay. We probably also need snakes. We definitely need rodents. We need big grasshoppers, probably dragonflies, right? So where does all this fit, right, in the diet of that bird? I think one of the things that were unexpected that we've learned so far is that red-bellied snakes play a huge role in American kestrel courtship up here. So if you want kestrels, probably think about red-bellied snakes. Do you have what they want? Because it seems to be that the male kestrels really like showing off red-bellied snakes to the females. To get them to enter those cavities to breed. So again, I think the hope is that we've been seeing a change in conservation from single species, we need this, 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 to, well, let's think about that ecosystem. What does this bird actually need? And that, to me, is a big change. And that's a really hopeful thing, because I'm a guy who really likes bugs a lot. So I think about bugs a ton when I think about kestrels. So it kind of forces us to do a bunch of things. And I think that makes conservation a little more robust. It's something more than just let's mow this field down and put up a box and call her good. Well, what's in that field? Is there food? Is there space for those nestlings? Which gives me certainly a lot of hope. A lot of people working on them lately, too, not just in the West. A lot of work in Utah, Idaho, doing a lot of work on kestrels, but we're starting to see in the Midwest a big resurgence of interest in kestrels, from working groups based in the UW-Madison to folks working on their master's thesis. Hallie worked on her thesis a couple years ago. It's a good bird to look at, but it also forces you to look at other stuff too, which I think is important.
Love that guy.
That's Clinton Dexter Nienhaus from the Sachs Zimbabwe. And you know, we learned in that conversation that once again, all roads lead to Carol Henderson.
Right? Carol Henderson. Yep. He began the non-game wildlife program in Minnesota, which is known throughout, I think, the nation and possibly the world. It's one of the most successful non-game wildlife places. We've got the tundra swan, bald eagle, so many success stories, and this great book, Woodworking for Wildlife. And just, I love what Clinton was saying about you can't just put up a box. You need to think about all of the things this bird eats, what it needs. It needs red-bellied snakes for courtship. And those red-bellied snakes need, like, slugs and snails to eat. Thinking about it from an ecosystem level, I think that's so correct and also just such a good way of seeing it laid out like that. I know for me, there are ecosystems that, like, really speak to me. Forests and rivers and those kind of ecosystems are where I feel at home and where I like feel really invested. I've never been a prairie person that much until I met my friend Steven, who works almost entirely in prairie grassland ecology and native species. And through like getting to know him and like connecting with him, all of a sudden I see prairies as a place that I love too, because they remind me of him. And I think the same thing happens when you fall in love with like a bird or another critter that you want to see more of and you want to protect and you want to stop its decline or just increase its numbers at your house, is all of a sudden you start seeing all the things that that bird needs and that bird loves and trying to protect all those. And it's just, it broadens your horizons in a new way.
You're making me think about how like antithetical it is to today, that we're used to like, okay, I never saw that TV show, so I'm going to binge watch every episode this weekend. Everything's right there. But, you know, even I'm just thinking about in the summertime, we know where the bald eagle nests are on our lake and we have the spotting scope there and we head over to a certain place, see if they're there, see if we see the youngster, you know. We don't have control over if it's there or not. We don't have, you know, we know it's there a certain time of the year. It's like we can't just push a button and whoop, there it is. And it's, I mean, I know I kind of always go big in our conversations here, but that is really good for the soul to like wait, have patience, watch,
hope.
Yeah.
And, you know, when they reintroduced the trumpeter swans, they had no idea if they would
50,000 right now. In fact, I think I think they're having to talk about that might be too many.
Yeah.
No.
I mean, we have by far the largest breeding population of the lower 48 states, a runaway success. But you don't know that at the beginning.
Right.
And, you know, with these American kestrels, you know, drop their populations decline by 2% every year, which isn't a huge number each individual year, but cumulatively is a big deal. And for people who know to look, you know, good friends and neighbors that they see every day on their way to work, and there it is on that pole. The hope is that by putting up a box and planting some native plants for all of those insects and not using herbicide on your lawn again for those, or not using pesticide on your lawn again for those insects, that, you know, you can hope to see more and more of them, or, you know, see a family emerge and be successful. But yeah, there's no guarantee and there's no shortcut.
So I kind of have an idea of what a kestrel looks like. I also understand a little bit of what a kestrel box, and I know where to go, right? I can go to the Saxinbog website to find out how to make a box. But I want to know what they sound like. Should we take a listen?
Please. That last one was a little alarm call. Yeah, very distinctive, very repetitive, like a little squeaky, I think.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit like maybe shoes on a basketball court.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, that's a good
way.
You've
got a good ear.
That's a good way to think about it. Do you see kestrels often?
So the area I'm in is pretty forested. On drives I do, you know, telephone wires are one of the best places to see them, like along agricultural fields and stuff like that. But we don't have many like nesting in our little forest river area. We prefer it more open habitat, lots of grasshoppers, mice, insects, red-bellied snakes.
Well, we always need to listen to a little bit. Who doesn't need to listen to a little bit of John Latimer? And this time he's introducing a lovely word for us as well.
Yes, another one to add to our vocabulary, lek, L-E-K.
I got a nice note from a good friend, retired game warden, guy named Jeff Burcham. He lives up in Bedette, and he told me that he was out on the lek. He took me out on the lek a couple years back, and I have not had an experience anything like that in my entire life. A lek is a gathering place where the sharptail. Other birds have leks as well. Even ants have leks. These are areas where mating happens, where courtship happens. And the sharptails do it early. And according to Jeff, this is right on time. This is not early, not late. It mixes in with a lot of his evidence. But he had 37 sharptail on the lek that he was observing. He has a blind out there and he can crawl in there and just sit quietly, and the sharptail gather, and the males have these weird dances and do these weird things with their throats and their wings, and it's just a real experience. I'm sure if you Googled it, you could find it online, but I tell you what, if you're in an area where there is a sharptail lek, find out about it and see if you can't get a chance to sit in a blind. There's nothing quite like it. It's really, really exciting.
Absolutely. When I was in grad school, I had an opportunity to go sit, wake up entirely too early for me and go and sit in a blind and watch. It might have been the greater sage grouse, not the sharp-tailed, but you know, there have been a couple moments in my life where I've felt like I am inside of like a nature documentary, like Planet Earth or something. And that is absolutely one of them. Yeah, blinds are available for like reservation through, I think the DNR has a few. There's a Sharp-Tailed Grouse Society that has links to some of the different blinds. And you can go rent them out and watch the sharp-tailed grouse do their thing if you're willing to wake up early. But
wow,
it's absolutely a sight. Our photographer, Lori Shaw, went out I think last year to get photos and video. And there's a great gallery on our website.
Okay. We should put a link to that so folks can take a look at it too. I must have missed that myself. So I'm looking forward to seeing that. Kind of made me laugh because, of course, now thinking the lek, but then, you know, anthropomorphizing it and putting it onto people. Mm-hmm. I was thinking I went to a barn dance last weekend, which in some ways is sort of mating ritual, right? It was Valentine's night. That was our lek.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean,
who jumped the highest and shook their tail the most.
I just made it weird, but you know what I'm saying.
Absolutely. Yep. No, dance is dance, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, the Season Watch Pod, we're getting into the time of year where things are changing and spring is coming. And that means we really want other voices. We really want other folks calling and leaving stories or messages for us.
Yeah. Or questions, you know? I'm always happy to do a little investigating.
Yes,
there's nothing I love more than a little curiosity Hydra.
And I love a little clickety clack of her old timey keyboard. So there we go. This just in. You can leave a voice memo for us. Find a link on the podcast platform or on our webpage. And you just record right there and you'll be a part of the Season Watch Pod.
Pretty please and thank you.
What do we want to end each week? We get a chance to end with a sound, but we want to make sure we thank all the folks involved in being able to bring you this information this week.
Absolutely. Community Science website, Zeno Canto, really came through for us again this week. The Coyotes were recorded by Greg Irving. We have the grouse sound from Paul Marvin and the American Kestrel from Stanislas Rosa. So thank you to all of those folks for getting out there and getting these sounds for us, because it's a really important resource.
And you can check our website as well for John Latimer's, his full phonology report, other student reports. That's all available at kaxe.org. That's Charlie Mitchell. I'm Heidi Holton. What are we ending our conversation with today?
So we are going to end with some of the sounds that come from a sharp-tailed grouse lek, and they are otherworldly and delightful.
Thanks, Charlie. Wow.
Mm-hmm. That kind of like bubbly sound?
Uh-huh.
Are these throat sacs that they have? That they like swang around and they... It's something.
Uh-huh.
And apparently to female sharp-tailed grouse, it's where it's at.
It's everything. It's not just something. It's everything.
Yeah.
There we go.